All right, everyone, get ready for a fascinating deep dive. Today, we're heading to modern India, a place where, let's be honest, history plays a huge role even today. And we've got some amazing sources to help us figure out how India's past is shaping the challenges it's facing right now. We'll be looking at political reforms, how the media is making an impact, economic disparities, and even how India's tackling environmental sustainability. All of this within the context of India's overall journey.
You know, what really stands out to me about this deep dive is how it's not just about getting where India is today, but also understanding how things that happened ages ago, like centuries ago, still have a say in the policy debates and societal shifts happening right now.
Kind of like solving a puzzle, but some of the pieces are from a completely different puzzle, right?
Correct.
To get the full picture today, we've got to trace back how India ended up here.
Exactly. And you know where this journey begins? Way back in the 1700s with the British East India Company. Now, you might think they were just a trading company, but they actually became a major governing force in India, and that set the scene for a lot of the complexities we see today.
Okay, so how did a company that was all about trade end up ruling a massive subcontinent?
Well, it was a gradual process, but a key figure comes into play in 1772, Warren Hastings. He was the first Governor General of Bengal, and his job was to bring order to a pretty chaotic political situation. And you know what? He basically laid the foundation for British rule, which lasted for centuries.
I was looking at the sources, and it seems like Hastings faced a ton of opposition. He even had to go through an impeachment trial back in England.
Oh, absolutely. But even with all that going on, he managed to set up systems of governance that, in many ways, were quite similar to the Mughal rulers the British were initially criticizing. They actually adopted practices like acknowledging the Mughal emperor's authority, they kept using Persian as the official language, and they even continued to support the religious institutions that were already there.
So it sounds like they were saying one thing, denouncing what they called despotic rule, but then doing something completely different by adopting those same practices. Mm-hmm. What was the logic behind that?
It's a complicated issue. But I think it shows how pragmatic the British often were. They realized that if they tried to completely change existing systems, things could get really unstable. So they went with what worked, even if it didn't exactly match their own beliefs.
I imagine this blend of British and Mughal practices must have left a lasting mark on how India's governance is structured today.
Oh, without a doubt. It created a hybrid system that still influences how India is governed. You can see traces of it in the legal system, the way administration is set up, and even some of the social hierarchies that are still around today.
Fast forward to the early 1800s, and the East India Company is controlling most of India. Then, boom, 1857, the Sepoy Mutiny. It's a turning point in Indian history, and I think it's really important to understand what caused it.
The Sepoy Mutiny really exposed how much resentment there was against British rule. It showed just how fragile their control actually was, and this was the turning point that led to the British Crown taking direct control of India in 1858, which marks the beginning of the British Raj.
The sources mention this British official, John Beams. His writings give us a really interesting peek into this period. He talks about the rising racial tensions and how anxious the British were about keeping control. Seems like the mutiny really shook things up for them.
Yeah, Beams's observations are really valuable because they come straight from someone who was there. He gives us a firsthand account of how the British were perceiving the challenges they faced. They were becoming more and more aware of the discontent among Indians and how nationalist sentiments were on the rise.
So how did the British react to this growing discontent?
They put policies in place to try and suppress dissent and basically show everyone who was in charge. Take the Vernacular Press Act of 1878, for example. That was their attempt to control Indian language newspapers. And then there was the Ilbert Bill controversy. That whole thing really highlighted the deep-seated racial prejudices that prevented Indians from playing a bigger part in governing their own country.
It seems like these policies, instead of calming things down, might have actually made things worse.
You know what? That's exactly what happened. These actions just pushed Indians further away and gave more momentum to the nationalist movement. And by the late 19th century, all these organizations were popping up across India, demanding more autonomy and, ultimately, complete independence.
Groups like the Triplicane Literary Society, the Mahajana Sabha, and the Indian Association, they were some of the early voices in this growing movement.
They were essential in shaping the whole conversation and getting people involved. Their efforts really paved the way for the Indian National Congress, which would eventually become the leading force in the fight for independence.
This period also saw a rise in communal tensions,
yeah,
partly because of British policies that were deliberately meant to divide and rule. like the partition of Bengal in 1905. That's a prime example of that strategy, right?
Oh, absolutely. The whole point of the partition was to weaken the nationalist movement by separating Hindus and Muslims. But you know what? It had the opposite effect. It actually made the movement stronger and deepened those communal divisions.
It's a classic example of how trying to control and suppress things can totally backfire.
And then there's another big development. Lord Minto decides in 1906 to go for separate electorates for Muslims. This meant Muslims would vote for Muslim candidates in their own separate constituencies. And that decision had some pretty long-lasting consequences.
I remember reading about separate electorates, but could you break down why this was such a controversial move?
Well, the idea was to represent different communities, but it also had the effect of making religious identities even stronger in politics. It contributed to the sense of separation and, in a way, planted the seeds for divisions down the line.
So even decisions made over 100 years ago are still having an impact today. It's amazing how these historical threads are woven into the fabric of modern India.
It's incredible, isn't it? And as we move into the 20th century, the struggle for independence really heats up, and it leads to India finally gaining its hard-fought freedom in 1947. But that independence brought its own set of challenges, and that's what we'll be diving into in the next part of our deep dive.
You're right. The story definitely doesn't end there. We've got so much more ground to cover when it comes to post-independence India, the obstacles it faced, and how it continues to deal with its colonial past.
Picking up where we left off, India's independence in 1947, I mean, it was a huge achievement, no doubt. But it also meant a whole new set of challenges, a new era for the nation. The sources we're looking at today, they really show how India tried to find its own way forward, all while dealing with the baggage it inherited from its colonial past.
Okay, so let's get into those challenges. What were some of the biggest issues India had to face right after independence?
Well, economic development was definitely at the top of the list. You have to remember, India was mainly an agricultural society back then, and poverty was widespread. Industrialization was limited. So to tackle this, they launched the Green Revolution in the 1960s. The idea was to introduce these high-yielding crops and modern farming techniques.
Yeah, the Green Revolution, it's often praised for boosting agricultural production. But I've also come across stuff about its downsides. What can you tell us about those?
You're right. There were downsides. The Green Revolution did increase food production, but it also created these regional gaps. Some areas benefited a lot from the new technologies, while others fell behind, and that just made economic inequalities worse. Plus, the heavy use of chemical fertilizers and pesticides, well, that raised concerns about the environment, whether it was really sustainable in the long run.
Sounds like a classic example of good intentions having unintended consequences.
Exactly. It shows how complicated development can be. You can't just focus on economic growth. You've got to consider social and environmental factors, too. A holistic approach, you could say.
So what about the political scene? How did India manage to establish a stable government that represented everyone after independence?
At first, it was the Indian National Congress, the party that led the independence movement that dominated politics. But as time went on, things got a bit shaky. In the 1970s, there was a period of real instability. You had the Janata Party coming into power briefly, and then Indira Gandhi came back.
Indira Gandhi's time in office, it was a mix of progress and controversy,
yeah,
right?
You could say that. She introduced policies to reduce poverty and improve social welfare. But her style of leadership, it became more and more authoritarian. It all culminated in the emergency period from 1975 to 1977, when civil liberties were basically suspended.
The sources also mentioned those terrible events of 1984, the assassination of Indira Gandhi, and then the anti-Sikh riots. I can't imagine the impact those events must have had on the nation.
Oh, they were deeply traumatic, no question. They showed how fragile social harmony could be and how communal tensions were still simmering beneath the surface. Her assassination, it was by her own bodyguards, retaliation for Operation Blue Star. That military operation in the Golden Temple at Amritsar, it sent shockwaves through the whole country.
And then the anti-Sikh riots that followed, it was just horrifying.
It was a dark time for India, a reminder of the dangers of religious extremism and how important it is to protect the rights of minorities. But those events were also a turning point in Indian politics. Rajiv Gandhi, Indira Gandhi's son, took over as leader and started a period of economic liberalization.
It seems like every step forward came with new obstacles. How did India navigate all of this in the late 20th century?
Well, the 1990s brought some big political and economic changes. Rajiv Gandhi and the governments that followed him, they introduced these liberalization policies. That led to more globalization and economic growth. But that growth wasn't always shared equally. The disparities continued.
So it was a bit of a balancing act, trying to boost the economy while also dealing with social inequalities.
Absolutely. And that's a challenge that's still at the heart of things in India today. But before we jump back into those modern day issues, our sources take us on a little side trip. We're going to explore a different part of India's heritage, Mughal architecture.
Mughal architecture. Yeah. I'm intrigued. How does that fit into our deep dive into modern India? What can these buildings from the past tell us about the present?
You know, Mughal architecture, with all its grandeur and symbolism, it gives us a glimpse into India's cultural history. It's the legacy of an empire that still shapes the nation's identity in so many ways. Those architectural wonders the Mughals left behind, they're not just tourist spots. They're physical reminders of a rich and complex past.
So it's not just about the bricks and mortar. It's about understanding the stories behind those structures and how they connect to India today.
Exactly. Take Humayun's tomb, for example. It's a magnificent building, inspired by those Timurid garden pavilions. It shows how fascinated the Mughals were with Central Asian traditions and how they blended those influences with Indian elements.
I've seen pictures of Humayun's tomb, and it's truly stunning. The intricate details, the sheer size of it, it's awe-inspiring.
It really speaks to the architectural skills of the Mughal era, their vision of creating these lasting monuments that showcase their power and artistic flair.
What about other examples of Mughal architecture? Are there any particular buildings that stand out to you?
Well, the Jami Masjid at Fatehpur Sikri is another one that's really interesting. It's a massive mosque that combines Mughal elements with features from pre-Mughal times. It highlights how architectural styles in India evolved and built on what came before.
It's like a visual representation of how history and cultural influences layer upon each other.
Yeah, and of course, you can't talk about Mughal architecture without mentioning the Taj Mahal. I mean, it's a masterpiece that transcends time and cultures, a symbol of love and loss that still captures the imagination of people all around the world.
But Taj Mahal is truly iconic. It's one of those structures that everyone recognizes, even if they've never set foot in India.
It's a testament to the Mughal Empire's grandeur and their ability to create buildings that resonate with people on such a deep emotional level. These architectural marvels are a powerful reminder that the past never really disappears. It shapes the present in countless ways, some obvious, some more subtle.
That's a great point. So as we shift back to those contemporary challenges facing India, how do these historical legacies, from the Mughals to the British Raj, continue to play a role?
They influence everything, from political debates to social structures, even how Indians see themselves in the world. But to really grasp the complexities of modern India, we need to dig into the specific issues that are shaping the nation's path in the 21st century.
You're right. We've laid the groundwork, explored the historical context. Now it's time to dive into the present, the challenges at the forefront of India's journey today. So we've covered a lot of ground, haven't we? From the East India Company to the challenges India faced after independence. Now let's fast forward to the 21st century. What are some of the big issues India is grappling with today?
Well, I think one of the most pressing challenges, and it's something that's on everyone's mind globally, is environmental sustainability. India's population is growing rapidly. There's more urbanization, industrialization's picking up pace, and all of this puts a huge strain on natural resources.
We're talking about air pollution, water pollution, deforestation, the impacts of climate change, right?
Mm-hmm.
All of those things.
Absolutely. And these issues are all tied up with this other big challenge, trying to grow the economy and lift millions of people out of poverty. It's a tough balancing act, for sure.
From what I've read, it seems like India is exploring different ways to tackle these environmental concerns. What are some of those efforts?
Well, India is investing quite a bit in renewable energy sources like solar and wind power. There are also initiatives to promote sustainable agriculture and improve how waste is managed. But, you know, the scale of the problem is enormous. It requires a constant commitment and coming up with new solutions all the time.
So it's not just about finding the right technology. It's also about getting people to think differently, change their behavior.
I couldn't agree more. To address these environmental challenges, everyone needs to be on board, the government, businesses, and individuals too. It's about understanding that our actions are interconnected, and they all have an impact on the planet.
Another challenge that keeps popping up in our discussion is the rise of religious nationalism. What does that mean for India's secular democracy?
It's a really complex issue. And as we saw when we talked about the partition of Bengal and separate electorates, it has deep historical roots. This rise of Hindi nationalism in recent years, it has raised concerns about whether secular values are being eroded, whether it's leading to even more social divisions.
It seems like finding that balance respecting religious identities while also upholding secular principles. It's a constant process, a delicate one too.
It really is. It requires people to be open to dialogue, to have empathy, and to commit to inclusivity. It's about recognizing that India's strength comes from its diversity. Protecting the rights of all citizens, no matter their religious beliefs, that's crucial for a democracy to truly flourish.
So as we wrap up our deep dive into modern India, what are some of the key takeaways you'd like listeners to walk away with?
I think the most important thing to remember is that India's story is a story of resilience and incredible transformation. This is a nation that's faced so many challenges, colonialism, poverty, social divisions, but it's still striving for progress, for a brighter future.
It's a story that's still unfolding, right? There are still challenges ahead, but there's also hope, a sense of possibility.
Absolutely. India's dynamic, it's complex, full of contradictions. It's a place where the past is always present, shaping the present and influencing the future.
I know I've learned a lot from this deep dive. I hope our listeners have too.
I hope you'll keep exploring, keep learning, keep engaging with the multifaceted story of modern India. There's always so much more to discover.
This has been The Deep Dive. Thanks for listening.